to another evening of Dharma exploration. Some of you might have been around a few weeks ago. We looked at the first story in a koan collection called The Book of Serenity. Koan means literally public case. It's a story, a case brought up for public viewing and discussion. One of Dogen's disciples, commenting on the word koan, said that ko, meaning public, refers to like universality. Equal treatment of everyone in the public domain. The public world includes everyone equally. And on, meaning like case, refers to particularity, something abiding in its own position, a particular case. So this way of looking at koan brings out the meaning of the union of universality and particularity in the very word koan. A koan is the meeting of universal principle expressed through a very particular case, a particular story. That's why there's so many of them. If it was just, if we just had a co-collection, it would just be one story. Everything would be revealed, but we need all these different particularities, all these different angles in which to view the universal principle. So we have many on, koan. This Book of Serenity is a collection of 100 unions of the universal and particular koans. Case number two, we usually bring up at the time of Shuso ceremonies. It's the center case that the Shuso brings up to investigate through and around about Bodhidharma meeting the emperor. So we'll skip that now. Let's wait for the next Shuso. Case three, public case three in the Book of Serenity, the invitation of the ancestor to Eastern India. Introductory words to this koan, demonstrating something of our family style here. Of Zen. Part of the reason that I like to bring up these stories is because it's like our Zen folk tales. It's like our family stories, and we're responsible for keeping them alive. It's like Grimm's fairy tales get passed along through hundreds of years, many generations. People keep telling them, and therefore they stay alive, and they have new meaning maybe for each generation. So these cases have been traveling through various languages and countries for about 1,000 years. So here's one that, whether you have or haven't heard it before, may it be alive this evening. And may you hear it as a demonstration of our family style. Particularly tonight's case is about Zazen practice, which is this, our central practice of just sitting. The introduction says, the state before the beginning of time, a blind turtle faces the fire. One phrase specially transmitted outside the scriptures, the lip of a clay mortar bears flowers. Now tell me, is there any accepting and upholding, reading and reciting in this? So again, this is just setting the stage in Zen style. The state before the beginning of time, a blind turtle faces the fire. You can try to get a hold of that if you like, but I don't recommend it. The one phrase specially transmitted outside the scriptures, outside of doctrine, this is, as you may have heard, the classic trademark or description of the Zen tradition. It's the special transmission outside the scriptures. That comes one phrase at a time. So the one phrase specially transmitted outside the scriptures is the edge or the lip of a clay mortar. I picture a mortar and pestle where you grind substances to mix together something good to eat and digest. You're doing this very practical work with a mortar and pestle, but meanwhile, the lip of the clay mortar is sprouting flowers. Despite all your hard practical work inside the mortar, that's what it is called, the one phrase specially transmitted outside the scriptures. Now tell me, is there any, quote, accepting and upholding, reading and reciting, unquote, in this? And this is a quote from many of the Mahayana sutras. Repeat this over and over again. They say, this sutra, like the Diamond Sutra or the Lotus Sutra, you should accept and uphold it. Accept the sutra, uphold the sutra, read the sutra, and recite the sutra. And there's much merit in this. So it's taking this phrase and saying, in this kind of like, you know, flowers sprouting out of the lips of clay pots, is there any accepting and upholding sutras in this? Is there any reading or reciting of sutras in such a thing? In blind turtles facing the fire, in flowers sprouting from the lips of mortars. This is the way the ancient spoke. We might say we have our, at the beginning of the talk, right? We do a verse called the Sutra opening verse, and it says, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. Same idea. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. So is there any seeing and accepting and maintaining, listening to, remembering, these sprouting flowers. That's the introduction. Now that you're all warmed up, here's the story. The case. A Raja, that's an Indian king, a king of an East Indian country, invited the 27th Buddhist ancestor Prajñātara to a feast, to a vegetarian meal. There's some scholarly debate about whether this 27th ancestor Prajñātara was male or female. It could be that in our lineage of Zen ancestors, which we most people have thought, well, they were all men up to Catherine Thanis. Our abbot Catherine Thanis may be the first woman ancestor in Suzuki Roshi's lineage. Is that right? Does anyone know that?
Blanche.
Oh, Blanche was before?
I think they're kind of the same time.
They were right together.
Mm. Yeah, so historical moment in the history of this 2,500-year-old lineage. Historical events are happening around this very temple in this lineage. But it may be that this 27th ancestor, who is the teacher of the 28th ancestor, Bodhidharma, may have been a woman. I think the reason they, the scholars are debating this is because the structure of the Sanskrit name can be read as a female name. Sanskrit works that way. I don't know enough about the details to let you know, but we can imagine her as the teacher of the great Bodhidharma. Could be a her or a him. So the king invited 27th Zen ancestor Prajñātara, the wisdom jewel, to a feast. And the king asked her, why don't you read the sutras? Because this was the tradition when teachers would be invited to a meal. They would chant sutras for the meal donor and dedicate the merit to them and their family. This is still, in fact, the practice in modern Japan. Sometimes we would, when I was practicing there, we would be invited as a group to a lay supporter's house for a sumptuous meal. And we would always chant at their home altar for them. So the king asked, why don't you read the sutras? They just ate and sat. We might infer. And the ancestor said, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of body or mind when breathing in. Doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always recite such a sutra. Hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. That's the case for today. And it comes very near the beginning of this book. This book, which is particularly connected with our particular universal Zen lineage, our Zen tradition based around this simple, profound, ordinary practice of just sitting. And I propose that this is a koan about just sitting, coming in the form of a story, as they usually do. It's a meditation instruction. why don't you read the sutras? The ancestor said, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of body or mind when breathing in, doesn't get involved in the myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always recite such a sutra, such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. Not just one in-breath and out-breath, but on each in-breath, don't dwell in the realm of body and mind. And if we want to get literal, what it says here is the skandhas, the five aggregates, and the breathing out, not getting involved in the myriad circumstances, is literally and technically the dhatus. So it's kind of like a little Abhidharma teaching in here, a little like, you know, Buddhist psychology teaching woven into a Zen, Zazen instruction. So, for those who haven't heard about the five aggregates, the five skandhas of body and mind, they're the body, which the body is actually five senses, five physical senses. It's technically what we mean by the body. When Buddhism is always trying to come from what's our experience of what's happening. So the body is, you know, sometimes they would say the body is four elements of physical elements of earth, wind, fire, and water. And sometimes they talk about 32 physical parts like organs of the body. But most commonly, the body, the physical form, is defined as the experience of five senses. Because that's how we experience the body, is through sight. So it's like the body is has both the receptors for sight, and actually has like is an object of sight too, and has the physical receptors for hearing, and it makes sound when you knock it. So that means it seems to be solid form. It has a smell, and it can smell. It has a taste, and it can taste. And it has bodily sense touch receptors, and it can be touched. So these five physical senses are like a kind of elaborate version of what we mean by the body. And any experience we have of a body, maybe mostly the fifth sense is maybe what we most commonly think of. I feel something in my stomach and my knee, and that's all the fifth sense, called the physical sensations, or you know, physical receptivity, touch. So that's form, skandha, of the five skandhas that make up body and mind. We have body, or five senses. We have feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. We have conceptions, the most basic labelings and discriminations of, you know, painful stomach, or red, white, blue. Those are discriminations, conceptions, very basic conceptions. And then we have karmic tendencies. We have all our habitual, almost like personality traits that make us unique, the way we respond to the five senses and to pleasant and painful situations and to our conceptions. The way we habitually respond to those first three is the fourth skandha of karmic formations, impulses, tendencies, and then we have consciousness gets mind perceiving a world apart from itself. So you could say body is the first skanda, and the other four are mind, feelings, mental conceptions, mental formations or karmic tendencies, and consciousness itself, awareness of stuff out there. Those are all mind. So if we haven't, you know, got the full picture of how all these work together, I think it's a nice summary to say body and mind, our body and mind experience. So when breathing in Zazen, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in those five skandhas. So we might ask, well, isn't that what we do though, actually? Don't we dwell in body, feelings, conceptions, our karmic tendencies, and our consciousness or awareness of things? And I would say, yeah, that is what we do. But this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in those realms. Doesn't dwell in body and mind. So that's one question we could ask, kind of a probing question arising from this koan is, where does such a poor wayfarer dwell, if not in body and mind? Any responses? Yes. Buoyant in Buddha nature. And who is that poor wayfarer?
Another way.
Thank you. And breathing out, this poor wayfarer doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances. Or if we're talking about these dhatus, these realms, they're basically, again, the objects of the senses. So, technically speaking, breathing out, we don't get involved in colors and shapes, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mental objects is the six, dhatu, objective, dhatu means realm, the dharma dhatu, the realm of phenomena, which are mental constructions. So there's kind of, you know, he could have reversed them, but it's kind of nice that breathing in, we notice all our internal world of body and mind, but we don't dwell there. Breathing out, we may notice the whole world of objects, but we don't get involved. Involved. We do live in this world, right? So what does it mean to not get involved, not to get caught up in, not to get overwhelmed by these objects? And that's why we've been studying this year the teachings of nothing apart from mind, and we'll continue some more in a couple weeks with another class series. basically these teachings are looking at these six objects that appear to be out there and saying, as long as they appear to be out there, it's going to be virtually impossible not to get overly involved with them. Virtually impossible. We might be able to like be really cool with them for a while if we're really quiet. Objects are, you know, knocking at our sense doors, but we're not totally caught up by them. But as long as they appear to be outside of us, knocking on our mind, there's the potential for them to. They'll just have to knock a little bit harder, and we're going to be disturbed by them. So these teachings of like the Lankavatara Sutra are particularly about studying very, very carefully and diligently and thoroughly the relationship of the myriad circumstances to us. What is that relationship? Are they really outside, apart from mind? Are they separate from us? Yes.
The merging and difference in unity is kind of going through my mind a lot in the part where you say fields interact and do not interact.
Yeah. Yeah. It even lists, right, eye and form, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, little Abhidharma and the merging of difference and unity. Interact and do not interact. My understanding of that is that it's not like they alternate interacting and then not interacting. We have this, I think, kind of a problematic line. When interacting, they also merge. Otherwise, they remain in their own place. And when we studied this poem last year, I personally felt like that word otherwise is kind of problematic. Otherwise. And I think if we look in the Chinese, it doesn't necessarily mean that. In other words, the senses and their fields interact, and yet, they're not truly interacting. They merge, and how about instead of saying otherwise, they remain in their own place when they're not merging? To me, the Dharma turns more brilliantly if we can see that as at the very time of their merging, they also remain in their own place, or in their own Dharma positions. They remain in their own Dharma positions that fully include each other and are yet independent of each other at the very same time. This is maybe a little divergence, but it might be actually a way to approach the meditation that he's talking about here. How to not get involved, overly caught up in the myriad circumstances of the objective world, where we can see that, well, we're totally, I am totally merging with this, ugly color of the floor. It's just like an ugly color, and now it's really disturbing me because like I'm meeting it fully. But if we could say each of us actually is, I'm in my own Dharma position, my eye organ's in its own Dharma position, and the ugly color of the floor is abiding in its Dharma position, independent, that we're not actually like getting caught up in each other. We're like free of each other at the same time that we're totally dancing. And then it's not so much like the ugly color is like threatening my very sense of being. Yes?
It's just, again, a tiny little divergence. But when you talk about the difference in unity, And that problem that we often have in understanding, well, how can we be merged and separate at the same time? I was studying, this guy was writing from the perspective of neurobiology, and he gave an example, and I thought it was a great example, and it's people singing in a chorus.
Mm.
As, you know, each individual person is completely got their part, especially if there's multiple parts in the piece, and is fully inhabiting their separate Dharma position. And yet, there is also, at the exact same time of being unique, there is this merging.
Yeah, one song.
Yeah. And I think that, for me, kind of helped as a way to think about this puzzle.
That's a beautiful example, I think, for merging or differencing unity.
I'm not quite sure how it connects to our feasting, breathing, and
yeah, it's a little on the side, but
it's connected.
It's about not getting involved in myriad circumstances that seem to be either. Or like, if we feel like something about, I think when we get caught up in the objects really impinging on us, it's kind of like we're singing in the chorus, say, and there's like, I'm right on tune. I might feel like I'm just, everything's going well, and then everybody else seems to be getting a little out of tune. And that's really disturbing for me, because it's my song, after all. Right? It's like we're seeing it from the perspective of like, it's really my song. I kind of forget that there's like other individuals singing at their own pitch. But if we can see that, so when it starts to blend into the oneness, ironically, I think that's when it's often disturbing, when it starts, everything starts merging. Is we feel like everything's impinging on us, but if we can see all those people in their separate Dharma positions, and there is another harmony here that's maybe not my idea of harmony, that comes from recognizing more the individuality, I would say, ironically, that's how it's coming to mind right now, rather than the merged whole. It doesn't have to be my version of the merged whole. It can be like each person's particularity is a beautiful expression. That's not complete, but something. We're playing around the edges of how the merging of difference and unity, or the appreciation of both difference and unity, the other way to put it, might help us to not get overly involved and caught up in the myriad external things when they seem to be all impinging on us at once. That was another story that came up at last week's session. When the myriad objects are all coming at us at once, what can you do? And the teacher answered, don't try to control them. And then Dogen commented on, don't try to control them because you can't. And the reason you can't is because actually they're not objects. They're actually Buddha Dharma, Dogen says. So these myriad circumstances and each thing in its own position, there's a way in which those things are not actually objects apart from us. That's another dimension here also. Breathing in. And, needless to say, but maybe not needless to say, this is a practice that can be done any moment. Such as, for example, like this one. This moment, as we're listening to this and trying to make some sense out of it, where we might notice that we're breathing I hope we're breathing. please do keep breathing. It, you know. And as we're breathing in, listening to this weird Zen stuff, can we not dwell, get stuck in our, you know, fixed position of body and mind? Like in a case like this, it might be like that fourth skanda might be acting up. I had a friend who used to say, I'm having a klesha attack. Kleshas are like, this is Sanskrit for like, you know, karmic afflictions, you know, of the fourth skanda. Someone might say, I'm having a fourth skanda attack. Right, you know, my habitual tendencies are like acting up. I have a bad case of habitual tendencies today. I think I should stay in bed. So, and our habitual tendencies might be like, yeah. I wish this was a Vipassana group. Where they just give you like straightforward Dharma instructions, like just breathe in and out. Instead of all this like stuff about flowers sprouting from lips of pots and stuff. So at such a time, can we like, you know, not dwell in that wish to be in a Vipassana group. That would be an example of as we're breathing in. I kind of do wish for to get out of here, but I'm not like dwelling in, I'm not abiding in that. I'm just like noticing that body-mind experience of a wish to have some more like straightforward instructions. And then breathing out, we might feel like it's hot in here. The objects outside us are getting disturbing. So not getting involved, overly involved in those. A similar story that's brought up in the commentary here is Emperor Zhuangzong of the latter Tang Dynasty invited Chan Master Chu Jing of Huayan Temple into the palace for a feast. And all the great teachers and worthies there were all reading sutras. Only Master Xu Jing's group was silent. Similar kind of case. Everyone was reciting sutras for the emperor, but this one group just was sitting there, just sitting here. And the emperor asked, well, why aren't you guys reading sutras like those other worthies? And Xu Jing said, when the way is easy, we don't pass along the imperial command. During the days of peace in the country, we stop singing the song of peace. When the way is easy, we don't pass along the imperial command. During the halcyon days, the happy, prosperous, golden days of the empire, we stopped singing the song of great peace. And the emperor said, well, for you not to read the sutras may be all right, master, but why don't your students read them either? In other words, you might be at peace and you don't need any more of those words, but what about those who don't get it yet? And Xu Jing said, in a lion's den, there are no other kinds of animals. Where the elephant walks, there are no fox tracks. We might hear that as a slightly arrogant statement, but for someone who's realized the way, truly, there is no arrogance. The Buddha, even in the early suttas, would say stuff like, someone would be debating with him, and he'd say things like, I suggest you take that back, because if you continue to hold that view for even a minute longer, your head will split into seven pieces, like a arjaka fruit or something. And I don't think he meant like, oh, I'm going to split your head. I think he just meant like, the karma of holding this false view in the face of like perfect wisdom is going to be very painful. And like, I don't want you to be in pain. But hearing those things, sometimes it sounds strange, like, that's a little much for the peaceful Buddha to say. So there's the verse in celebration of this story, like the introduction. The verse brings up other unusual images, but it goes, a cloud rhino gazes at the moon, its light engulfing radiance. So breathing in would become kind of like a cloud rhino. If we're not dwelling in body and mind, a rhino is a big solid thing, but a cloud rhino just gazes at the moon and soaks up the radiance of the moon. The moonlight just passes through the cloud rhino. A wood horse romps in spring, swift and unbridled, breathing out, not involved in all of his circumstances. It can just run and play like a wild wooden horse. Under the eyebrows, a pair of cold blue eyes, which is the Chinese way of identifying Indians, the blue-eyed ones. So Prajnatara with her beautiful blue eyes. Under the eyebrows is where they reside. How can reading sutras reach the piercing of ox hide? How can you break through the tough leather of self by just reading sutras? The clear mind produces or transcends vast eons. Heroic power smashes the double enclosure. The double enclosure of the realms of body and mind inside and the realms of myriad circumstances outside. In the subtle round mouth of the pivot turns the spiritual works. Hanshan forgot the road by which he came. Shuddha led him back by the hand. It's these two famous old crazy Chinese gesture monks. Hanshan, the great poet, Cold Mountain, who forgot the road by which he came, referring to the emperor. Why don't you, the Raja king, why don't you read the sutras? He kind of forgot his breath. He forgot just like not dwelling or getting caught up in anything. So Shuddha, his friend, led him back by the hand into the freedom from being stuck in body and mind and being stuck in myriad things. So I would propose that this is not what we call mindfulness of breathing. It's a little different, and the commentary brings this out too. Mindfulness of breathing is just noticing the breath, but this is something a little more subtle. Based on, we could say, mindfulness of breathing, based on just noticing the breath, but then settling more and more into that, we don't even dwell in the breath. The breath is part of the body. We don't get involved in the sensation of the cold air coming through the nostrils. The world is not as it seems. This body and mind is not as it seems. I hope this has been encouraging Zazen instruction. A kind of elaborated description of what we mean by just sitting, free from all obstructions. Please enjoy your freely flowing breath for the rest of this life, to that very last one where the myriad circumstances release you temporarily. We dedicate any merit arising from this conversation to the complete, perfect awakening of all living beings. May they realize inconceivable freedom and joy in the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.